Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 25th, 2018. This is the week 3 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So, tonight's talk is on the Four Noble Truths, something I've never talked about before.
How many?
Yeah, there's four. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, which states from ignorance, a very specific ignorance of these Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences, and in general, the suffering associated with having a human life. When the Buddha described that suffering, we mentioned it a little earlier, he just said that birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what you want is suffering. Or at least disappointing, isn't it? And that disappointment becomes a distraction. Getting what is undesired, getting what you don't want, is suffering, is dukkha. And there's a few other qualifications that he would put in there at times. But he would always close that description of dukkha by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. And we're going to get to it. We'll spend 2 weeks, actually, on five clinging aggregates. But the five clinging aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. Another way of saying that is we have a vehicle that we're able to experience our own suffering, rooted in form. The Buddha's very first teaching, then, was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta that, for the first time in human history, these Four Noble Truths were described by an awakened human being so that we have a way of thinking in the world to end our own ignorance. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths cause suffering. If we can find out, recognize our own ignorance and let go of that ignorance, become empty of ignorance, then we will be living very mindful lives rooted in wisdom. But the problem is, a mind that is rooted in ignorance creates very subtle but very powerful strategies to continue to ignore its own ignorance. In a very real way, you could say that the world has developed in a way that allows all of us to ignore our own ignorance. There's constant distractions that have arisen. Some of the most wealthiest people that have made their money in the last 20 years made it because they figured out a way to be so distracting that we can't stop using whatever they're selling. Facebook, Twitter, really the internet in general. Google is one of the most well-funded companies in existence. Based on search. What is search? Most of the time, search is, what's the best chocolate cake recipe? And things like that. I don't want to get too far down that road, but they realize that the insatiable search for information, and most of that information is mundane and not very useful, but that would be the most compelling thing that would happen in our lifetime. And it's true. Google made its money on search and then selling advertising to back up what people are searching for. Brilliant. Mark Zuckerberg and his partner, I can't think of, remember his name right now, they did the same thing with Facebook. In fact, his partner, and I wish I could remember his name, said something about 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks ago that before they released Facebook, him and Zuckerberg had a serious conversation about, isn't there a possibility that we can so distract people that will cause them harm? And their biggest concern was children. And he said, basically, they went ahead and did this anyway. He has some qualms about it. I don't know if Mr. Zuckerberg does. I'm getting a little bit off the point. The point is that we become distracted by our need for constant sensory input and constant sensory approval. I like this. And we maintain that distraction by hoping to avoid anything that would impact what's giving us pleasure or take away from it. We become so distracted by that. Diane.
I don't know whether if this is inappropriate and unskillful, then tell me and I'll
okay.
Or something like that. But what you're describing, these distractions, is okay. Maybe I'm getting off on what you said about the children, because there are a lot of older people who just do not want to have iPhones and computers. And they're getting lost in the shuffle. And even if they don't have these things as distractions, but it's doing them a lot of harm. I guess I'm really off on that tangent. I don't mean to.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. And it's not really, it's not inappropriate in any way, because it points directly to the Eightfold Path and the Middle Way. Remember when the Buddha taught the middle way in this sutta, by the way? He described it as the middle way between extreme views and the extreme behavior that results from wrong views, meaning the need for constant sensory indulgence. So there's nothing inherently wrong or inherently right with modern technology. It's how we use it. I mean, a good example might be, I don't want to use that because it's too controversial. Well, you know what? I was going to say a car, but actually my next thought was a gun. There's nothing inherently wrong with a gun. In fact, you could say that humans wouldn't have survived if they didn't figure out a way to hunt better. But from someone rooted in wrong views, a gun becomes horribly hurtful, doesn't it? It's really not a good metaphor, because most of the distraction of modern technology is simply overindulgence. It's not just, you know, it's not something growing out of a need to hurt other people. But that overindulgence is lacking the middle way. It's lacking an understanding of restraint. It's lacking that, okay, maybe Facebook would be a good thing for me to keep in touch with my family and friends and do an occasional post. I should also let you know that I don't spend much time on Facebook, so I don't quite understand it. I do understand that way too much time and way too much distraction takes place in all of that modern technology, because we haven't learned to practice restraint. Wine has been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and most people have no trouble with it, but I did. But I can't say we should ban alcohol just because I had some problems with it, and I'm not saying we should ban the internet. The fact that older people who aren't taking up technology are in some ways left behind. Yeah, but that doesn't correlate to the misuse and overuse of it. So it's just because some people aren't.
I guess that what I'm trying to address is that the corporations and doctors and the whole system doesn't account for the people who aren't technically savvy.
Yes.
Well, they're waiting for them to die off, I think, is the main thing.
Yeah, I'm not following you. Now, let me put it this way. The first noble truth, dukkha occurs, describes everything that's happening in the world. As a consequence of having, and this relates to the four noble truths, as a consequence of having a human life, dukkha occurs. That's the first noble truth. And that dukkha occurs is not right or wrong. As a society, as we try to continue to grow and establish our society, we engage in things such as legislature, creating laws, to help govern ourselves and steer us in the right direction. But no law is ever going to take away dukkha. We can't legislate out dukkha. It can't be done. So there's always going to be aspects of dukkha in any situation, including technology. So there's some people that are left behind. That's just the way it is, Diane.
Yeah.
And it's not right or wrong. It's not something to even take up a cause about. It might be something to recognize. In fact, boy, I am getting off on a tangent. One of the things that our governing bodies are trying to establish is nationwide broadband connectivity, because they understand the underlying importance of people staying connected that way. But, you know, that's another social issue. The point of all that is, we've created incredibly powerful structures in our society that allow us to continue our own, to continue to distract us from facing our own ignorance. And it all works that way. So that's enough on that subject. The Buddha described this in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, describing his awakening and what he understood. These are the Buddha's words. Vision arose, discernment arose. Discernment is another way of seeing things clearer, understanding or wisdom. Discernment arose. Insight arose. Knowledge arose within me. It's an important two words there, within me, of things never heard before. The Buddha is describing something, and he's making the point that this understanding has never been present in humankind up until now, and that it came within him. It was through his own efforts. When the Buddha described himself, he didn't describe himself as some mystical or magical or superhuman being. He simply described himself as a rightly self-awakened one. Rightly points to the entire Eightfold Path, and self-awakened points to that we can do it ourselves if we're willing to put in right effort, the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. There's nothing exceptional about people that awaken except they've become rightly self-awakened through their own efforts. It's within us. It's not from external sources. It's not from doing enough bowing. It's not from doing enough chanting. It's not from doing enough praying. It's not from doing enough worship that we gain awakening. It happens within us from changing the way that we think. Things never heard before, the Buddha continues. The truth of dukkha, now he's describing developing understanding of the four noble truths. The first noble truth is dukkha occurs. Awakening, as the Buddha described it, is the truth of dukkha has been comprehended. When he describes an awakened human being from the point of view of right view, he says right view is a view that completely understands at a penetrative level suffering. That's the description of awakening. To some people, they'll say, well, that's not even really worth chasing after, is it? Until you understand that we spend our whole lives distracted by the preoccupation with dukkha. That describes mindlessness. Not being mindfully aware of what's occurring in the present moment. And the only way we can do that is by developing a framework for looking at the world through the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues. Before I say this, the second noble truth states that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. The Buddha awakening to the second noble, describing that in his own awakening process, is that the origination of stress has been abandoned. Simple and direct and incredibly powerful. He's recognized and now abandoned the cause of his own distress, his own confusion, his own deluded thinking. He has recognized it and abandoned it. As this relates to the third noble truth, the Buddha says, the cessation of stress has been experienced. That's the third noble truth, says that the cessation of dukkha is possible. It points us in the right direction, does it? And to me, it's not the most important noble truth, except it points to impermanence and it points to the ability of individual awakening. It's possible to do this. And why should we even believe that? Because an awakened human being told us so. Now, if we don't want to believe that Siddhartha Gautama developed a way of awakening, okay, then go do something else. You know, get on Facebook. But if you do believe, and this is after careful, we don't take anything in faith in as far as what the Buddha taught. I almost said we don't take anything in faith in Buddhism. Most of it is taken on faith. The Buddha taught nothing to be taken on faith. He taught it to be directly experienced. Having a direct experience of developing an understanding of the nature of suffering, the nature of distraction, the nature of confusion, and the nature of deluded thinking. Developing a complete understanding of the nature of our own dissatisfaction. And how do we do that? Within the Buddha's words, the Eightfold Path is the path leading to the cessation of stress. And he has developed it. If those of you that are on retreat or have read the Nagara Sutta, well, remember that in that sutta, the Buddha describes the process of his awakening and developing during that awakening, the general understanding of the Eightfold Path, that we, in order to awaken, we need to incorporate and integrate right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation as the overall framework of our awakening. The Buddha's description of his awakening includes the Eightfold Path. His very first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, I say that often because I like to say it, describes, again, the path to awakening. I spent many, many years studying diligently, putting a lot of time in, really literally traveling over the world, chasing down teachers that I thought were important. And I never heard any reference to Four Noble Truths or Eightfold Path. Never. Eventually I did. But it was, even then, it was portrayed almost as an anachronism or something to kind of, you know, maybe think about, but not as a Buddha's teachings on how to awaken. It wasn't until I abandoned all that other stuff and started studying the Pali Canon, particularly the Sutta Pitaka, that I realized that everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of dependent origination and the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in context of Four Noble Truths. And we talked a little bit about that before. That's why everything that I teach and have been teaching here for, I don't know, 8 years or so is only in that context. It's why the only thing that I'll teach is what I found and learned from the Sutta Pitaka. And the reason why I do that is because that's the only way that I can be certain to not contribute to the confusion and deluded thinking of anybody that might come and listen to me. I don't want to interject something that might seem more appropriate 2,600 years later, because I found nothing in the 2,600 years that have passed since the Buddha's passing that deserve changing it or altering it or embellishing it in any way. It's the most pure, most powerful teachings, I think, that have ever been given to humankind, and it should be treated that way. So going back to the Four Noble Truths now, the Four Noble Truths describe the... Who was it that was here? It might have been Greg. Was describing the Four Noble Truths from a medical standpoint. Like this. A good doctor first describes the disease, doesn't he? The disease. First Noble Truth. The disease is dukkha. Just like a good doctor will describe then the cause, so we understand what we did and what we can do to change, to bring that disease on, if it's something we did do. Craving originates, clinging perpetuates, that's suffering. And like a very good doctor, it'll say, but all is not lost. The treatment for dukkha is right here in front of you. It's an Eightfold Path. And the Buddha is often described as the great physician. And when you look at it that way, he understood the nature of all human disease, but more than that, he provided the perfect cure. And it doesn't take universal health care to do it. All we have to do is to engage in the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort, and put in the effort to meditate, to deepen our concentration, so that we can then incorporate and integrate the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. And all of that is included. And I'll end with this. When you really understand the Four Noble Truths and what they say and how powerful and deep they are, you understand that the answer to every human problem is included in the Four Noble Truths. Now, the Buddha would spend the next 45 years of his life teaching the number that's often used is 84,000 different discourses, suttas. That number just means a lot. Describing in a situational way how to develop awakening in relation to Four Noble Truths. Every sutta points to that. Many of the suttas that have been taken out of context, and many of them have had small sections taken out of, and then taken even that out of context. The suttas that have been taken out of context have been taken out of context because whoever has done that has chosen to ignore the Four Noble Truths, ignore ignorance. And that's why the embellishments and the accommodations made to the Buddha's teachings often only lead to more confusion and deluded thinking than actual delivering awakening. The Buddha's path is enough. It's an awakened human being's path. That's my talk for today. Any questions on the talk? And then we're going to go around the room and I'm going to ask you a specific question. No, everybody's good. So what I'd like to hear, and Mike, I know you haven't been keeping up with this, but I think you've been doing this long enough. Do you see the Four Noble Truths the way I just described it and as, and the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Path, as the path to be integrated to develop awakening?
I'm not saying this, trying to sound smart or whatever, but very early on when I started taking your class here, it just made so much sense to me.
Yeah.
My problem was implementation. I've over the last, I guess, year or two, I've peppered you on occasion with these hypotheticals. What happens if somebody does this or that or whatever, or something happens at work, what do I do? My challenge is kind of sorting through all the difficult challenges that you face and kind of just sticking to it. I mean, I kind of feel like somebody who says, yeah, that antibiotic there, that's going to make me feel a lot better. I know it is really good stuff, but I don't take it. Or I don't take it the way it's prescribed. So that's been my challenge, but I think I've talked to other people and explained it to them, and it's just so sensical and just, you know.
Yeah. So that the aversion to taking the antibiotic, even though you know it's good for you, is the common human problem that the Buddha realized and why he taught an Eightfold Path, because that's the natural tendency of a conditioned mind to not do anything that would change the way it's thinking or anything that would challenge it. It's that subtle strategy that I keep talking about to continue to ignore our own ignorance. Especially when you... It often comes up when people finally get an understanding of what this really is, and that hasn't put the brakes on, because they don't want to change. They don't want to actually realize that the way they've been looking at themselves in relation to the world has been, to use the word, a wrong view. Nobody wants to admit that. And there's a great aversion to that. It's the reason why the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is there, right effort, to acknowledge the difficulty in continuing to awaken and to give us some encouragement and direction. Right effort means meditate, deepen your understanding of the Eightfold Path like you're doing right here. And then the third refuge that we talk about, being part of a Sangha. It's so important. We can't do it alone. The great thing about a noble truth, the word noble applying to the Four Noble Truths does not imply that it's only for people of nobility. It's made for every human being. The word noble refers to like a noble family, a royal family. Their rule lasts forever. It lasts throughout lifetimes, generally. Not always. But. So a noble truth is a truth that prevails despite whatever's going on in the world. And so the truth is just as applicable in your life today as it was during a Buddha's time. The difficulty is we have to develop it.
Well, my challenge is life being suffering to me is very obvious. And I've known that my whole life. But I'm addicted to distraction.
Yep.
I've avoided these suffering, unpleasantness, all kinds of things like that, things that I don't want to do, by distracting myself.
Everybody does, Mike.
Yeah, and I'm very aware of it. I mean, to the point that, you know, like, I have sleep issues. I can't just not often fall asleep. I lay down, and I've got to, like, start thinking about something to distract me from obsessing over, okay, what do I have to do for work tomorrow?
Yeah.
Am I going to get this? So the guy's coming to fix the air conditioner. How much is that going to cost? Because my mind will immediately go to unpleasant thoughts. I have to distract myself with pleasant ones.
What's the antidote to distraction? Concentration.
I totally, totally know that. It is just so hard for me after 50 years of doing it this way. That's been my defense mechanism on how
yes.
to deal with it.
Again, that's everybody's. Diane, can I ask you a question?
This is a test.
Yeah, easy, I know.
That's right.
It took you a little while to develop concentration, didn't it?
Oh,
it didn't happen.
I can relate.
Lisa, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
It took you a little while to deepen your concentration?
Hell no, no. You know, and I'll share if it's okay. I totally get where you're coming from, Mike. I'm sitting back here with, I have a blooming headache, and I'm bouncing over, clinging, craving, desire. I'm clinging to the fact that it's bothering me. I'm craving relief, and I desire that I don't have this headache anymore. But I keep coming back to my breath.
Deepen concentration.
And what I realize so strongly is the absolute importance of this. It's so simple. Like, everything is just simple. It might not be easy, but it's simple instructions. And the meditation or the grounding of that breath, for me, allows me to have all those pieces.
Yeah.
And I'm very... I like to know how to do it, you know, like exactly how to do it, giving the instructions so I can do it and have success. Yeah. But that's where I get stuck, is my clinging or my craving or desire, and all the words are the same for me, for being an expert or being, you know, perfect at it or...
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Thank you. and Kevin, it took you a couple of weeks to develop concentration? I'm making light a little bit light of it, but the point of it is that it is simply through right effort that you'll lose that all those distractions at night. It takes a while.
Oh, I've had times that I have. I mean, I have had months go by where I was coming here regularly. I was really working on my practice, and I know I can do it. It's just I get something goes wrong or whatever, and I fall into bad habits.
Well, that's where the again, what I'm trying to, I don't mean to interrupt you, but what I'm hoping to do is to point out to you the efficacy of the Eightfold Path. Maintaining right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So holding that intention, when you realize that you're distracted, you can take a breath and come back to what's occurring right now, realizing the impermanence of any situation. And also, as your mind quiets down, you realize if in any situation there's something that you can do, and you also understand your limitations about changing most things, and you'll just stay present and realizing the nature of impermanence. No matter what's occurring, it's going to change, no matter what it is. And in general, there's not much of an influence that we can have on what's occurring in life, especially on other people. Other people are part of dukkha. Dukkha occurs, especially people that are unawakened. Diane explained a situation to me to me that happened to her today. There was a lot of dukkha in it, most of it caused by other people. We're not going to isolate ourselves. You know, that's not the way that we live our lives. So again, I'm glad you're here tonight. Everything you described as difficult in relation to the Dhamma falls away, but it takes some effort. So I hope you come back again soon.
Oh, I want to, you know, again, it's, you know, work hours and you know, trying to get here on time and everything. It's just been...
All you can do is...
But I missed it, I mean, tremendously.
You know, yeah. Just do the best you can, Mike, and be gentle with yourself. Don't judge yourself harshly. Every moment is a... A deep understanding of impermanence also points to what's occurring in this moment, at any point in the timeline of our life. Whatever's occurring in this moment, there is an opportunity to incline my mind towards awakening, and that's by developing the framework of the Eightfold Path through concentration. At any point, it doesn't matter, you know, when we jump on that path or get on that path. So now's a good time to continue. You know, we've learned a lot so far. I'm glad you're here. Really, it's a good time to come back. You know, we're right on the Four Noble Truths. Next week we'll be getting into the Eightfold Path, so it's a good time to be here. Glad you're here. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I don't have a question. Oh, no. The same question. And I can see what Mike means. You know, I've actually had a kind of an auspicious week of meditating, especially in the mornings. My concentration seems to be blissful. I mean, it gets to be so deep that, and it's almost like my breath is so subtle that I can. I'm. I, it it's there and I'm aware of it, but it's so it's not a distraction either, and then thoughts are not a distraction. But then I finish my session and then I have to continue my day. And we all do, I think, you know, because we're doing our right livelihood and we have our families and our lives, and that distraction takes you away from it. And for hours and hours all day long, it's like, oh, you know, what's the Dhamma? You know, you don't have time to think of it, maybe. But, no, I think you do. I mean, sometimes it gets away from you, but then you can always take a breath and then think, okay, I want to speak correctly. I want to, you know, act in the right manner, etc. And you keep that. You can keep it. But it is very distracting. Sure. As you're falling asleep and you have those distractions, you can think, well, I'm going to be here now and deepen my concentration, and those problems will be there tomorrow. And when they come, then you'll have deepened your concentration enough that when you face them, that you'll be able to face them just with kind of equanimity. Maybe.
Yeah. Thank you. That you're describing beautifully how this develops, you know, and how concentration develops. Even that last part, as our concentration increases during meditation, it often feels like that. Or almost we don't have to at some point purposely be mindful of the breath. It's more of a subtle awareness and a very powerful but subtle focus. Mm-hmm. The breath is there. That's an experience of a well-concentrated mind. It's an experience of the jhanas, the four levels of meditative absorption that the Buddha described. And that fourth level, and this is not something we should chase after, but that fourth level of that, just that subtle awareness of the breath and our minds resting in peace, is the fourth level of the fourth jhana, the mind resting in equanimity. Now, an awakened human being who has fully developed the Eightfold Path, their mind rests in that off their cushion too. But I think you're also describing that you've developed that to a certain extent. But life goes on. You know, we have to be out in the world. And there's a lot of stress in the world. Hopefully we don't lose our minds by what's occurring. But the Dhamma gives us an anchor, you know, something to really hold our mindfulness and our concentration in. So, thank you. Lisa, good to see you tonight.
Oh, very good to be here. I was contemplating staying home. And I thought, no! I missed last week, and it's really important for me to be here. And the instructions are so simple in the Four Noble Truths. That's what I love about it.
Yeah.
It's just like, of course it carries all these years. And I love sharing with my friends, I love throwing clinging, craving, and desire. Every time I say that, I'm like, yeah, shit happens. And it happens because you're stuck to something, you want something different, or you're craving something you don't have. And you're like, yeah. Like, it's so fun to see that it's so simple for them to get that peace.
Yeah.
And then I talk, I'm like, well, there is a way out. And believe it or not, it's silent. You know, it's not silence. It's quiet meditation to sit down. And when I take the time to meditate, it's so important for me. And I have a chitty chatty mind in the evening as well, because apparently that's my, when I'm overly busy, that means it's the first time I have a chance to start processing.
Yeah.
So I have gotten into a habit of going to bed an hour earlier so that I can do some of that quiet time of meditating while I'm lying down, you know, even if it's, sometimes I might be even just reading a book or something, but I have to give my mind the chance to come up with the things at least I need to do it, you know, in the morning, and then put it aside so that when I'm really getting ready to turn the light off and get in, like, I'm done now. But that's been a habit I formed because I've been noisy since I'm little. So the more I take the time to do the meditation twice, is the critical part. The morning, it sets me and it sets my tone for the day. But it's that evening space that allows me to have a more peaceful sleep. It doesn't always work. And I'm still a work in progress. But, and I'm fortunate that I've been working, you know, I've been attending this for years. I have a little gap here and there. But I do take it off the cushion. And I do it when I'm sitting in traffic. And I do it when other people are having a meltdown. And just kind of coming back to the breath, like that's so important. And to me, that's like I can meditate whenever I want. I can meditate in the middle of chaos. And one of the things I remember from you so distinctly is that importance of taking the posture. Mm. And, you know, the hand in the hand and the sitting up. And I can do that almost anywhere. Mm. And the second my hand hits, when my right hand goes on top of my left hand, all of a sudden I like go into concentration. I'm not perfect at it. It doesn't work immediately. But it is amazing that it's like a training. So the more I can do that and the more often I try and practice that throughout the day, and it doesn't matter where I am, it's so grateful. So helpful. So yeah, it's been a better week or so. I'm working on self-compassion. That seems to be my biggest gap.
Yeah, being gentle with yourself.
Yes, in all aspects of my life.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for letting me yammer.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm so glad you made it tonight. Diane, good to see you.
Really good to be here. I was thinking of an experience I had a week or so ago. I like sweet coffee. And I woke up one morning and I was thinking, I would really like sweet coffee. But all I had made was this tea made up called Horehound tea, and it's really good for congestion and stuff like that, and the pulmonary part of us, and all I had was that, and I thought, I don't really like that, but that's all I have, you know. I had water, I mean, my choices, and I was, you know, kind of mumbling through all this, and all of a sudden, it was like a little light bulb went off or something. It said, you don't like, that's a thought. You can change that thought to either you like it or it really doesn't make any difference. And it was like, I mean, in just little increments in my life, that has been creeping around like, it doesn't make any difference whether I like it or don't like it. And I had an issue when you started these things that people had to know what they liked and didn't like. That was you know, made them who they were, and how you made decisions and all that kind of stuff. And the ego is important in building that. And you can't say there's a non-self unless you know the ego self, I mean, unless, you know, you have a self to let go of. And it's the same thing with the, I struggled with that in the beginning, but when I saw this like and don't like and it doesn't make any difference, and when I thought about the sweet coffee versus the Horehound, I really thought, the Horehound's a heck of a lot better for me than the sweet coffee is. And, I can make choices of what's, and I start, it's tumbled over into my eating habits. I, when I'm at the grocery store, if I don't buy it, I won't eat it. And that's been a really good mantra to have. And basically that's, and eat, my mother-in-law, I'm not sure whether she likes me or not, and I'm going to visit them tomorrow. She's going to have a baby February 1st, and so I'm going to be up in Colorado for a while. Anyway, and I went back to this little coffee thing, and I thought, that's a thought. And she said maybe some things that, you know, didn't roll on too real, you know, feel good. But I thought, those are thoughts too. I can go out there with this protective, defensive attitude, or I can just like, don't like, it doesn't make any difference. Mm. I can just I can go be me and have fun if I want to.
Thank you. Yes, the whole point is not taking anything personal. You know, and gaining, we gain the ability, the Buddha said in the Vitakka Santana Sutta, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We gain the ability to think skillfully and appropriately to what's occurring, rather than coming from a false understanding of self, continued eye making. So,
I have a question.
Sure.
And I don't know if this is relating back to the teachings or not. I think I have lived my whole life from the emotional level. And I've never really believed that I really even understood what change your thinking means. And there's a lot of, one of the aggregates is feelings. And it's like, holy tamale. And then my mind kind of goes off. Well, there are a lot of people who feel more, you know, are more sensitive and stuff like that. And I'm the question is, and I don't, the question might be, maybe are they less intelligent because they're so emotional, or are they, do they have a longer way to go to change their thinking? Because, I mean, what you're talking, the, you know, when you, I think that's great. Don't take it personally. But a feeling person takes it personally. When this person reneged on me this afternoon, I initially felt, how could she do that? What did I do to, but then I started breathing again. And anyway.
Thank you. So I don't mean this to, my response is not to dismiss your question. It's an important question. But I am going to dismiss the question this way. As far as awakening, developing the Dhamma is concerned, it doesn't matter if sensitive people happen to have less intelligence or more intelligence, even if you could prove it, if you could do some kind of studies and show that, well, yeah, people that are more sensitive, they have lower IQs. It may be true. That thought itself doesn't relate to awakening. It doesn't matter. Because it's an outwardly focused, the more I think about it, I'm glad you brought it up, because that thought is an outwardly focused thought of how other people should be in relation to your own views of yourself. Do you see the feedback loop in it? It simply doesn't matter, because even that thought is taking it personal. And I did something that what the Buddha would often do when a question like that doesn't relate to the Dhamma, that way he would respond.
Okay.
Me, I'm, you know, okay. I got to say something about everything. So, but again, we can get so caught up in it. It's almost looking for ways that the Dhamma doesn't apply, or how can it apply to this and that. The truth is the truth. And the only way you can develop it is to develop it. I started out this evening talking about a little bit about the nature of distraction. It's those types of things that continue to distract us. There's a huge, very powerful, and I think it's even increasing in momentum, move or concept in modern Buddhism. In modern Buddhism, and even in the world at large, that the world is so screwed up right now that it's selfish to just sit and meditate. But the world is so screwed up right now because there's a lack of understanding of the way things really are, and lack of understanding of Four Noble Truths. So the most loving thing that I can do, and this is, I'll close with this because you hear me say it all the time, the most loving thing that I can do for myself and for every other single human being on the planet is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Along the way, I might decide to, you know, join a protest or write a letter or do this or do that. But underlying all of that so-called engagement, social engagement, in fact, what I would say is all of that social engagement is going to lead to more difficulties unless it's rooted in the wisdom of an awakened human being. And we can see that all the time. You know, so I really went off on that point you made. The point is to keep it focused, to not be too concerned about what's going on in the world at any point, because the world is a constant distraction. Other people are part of that. What's most important is to understand on a moment-by-moment and then daily basis the importance of our own singular awakening, because that really is the only thing that we have true control over. The only thing we can control is the way we think and the way we react or respond to the world. And this is the only way that I've come across that really delivers that. A well-concentrated mind that is, whose mindfulness is framed by the Eightfold Path, meaning their mindfulness is framed by the way things really are, the Four Noble Truths. And so when all the distractions arise in the world and it seems like there's no time to spend 5 or 10 minutes meditating or maybe another 10 minutes reading about the Eightfold Path, remember that. Practice restraint at the distraction. Add another minute to your meditation and listen to some useful tapes and awaken. So that's the end of all of my talks tonight. Any other questions about tonight? This week we're going to begin our 3 weeks on the Eightfold Path, and we'll be studying the wisdom factors of the path. And that's what I'll give a talk on that next week, and that's what we'll talk about. So the retreat, spring retreat, is May 17th to the 20th. The registration is up on the website, and you'll get an email on Sunday just kind of announcing that. But and the only thing I would ask is if you're going, and you know you're going, the sooner you sign up, it helps me greatly with my planning and logistics. So I hope you can all join us. Let's finish with metta. Find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Thank you all for joining online. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.